fourth case of the morning, number 024206, Shallow against Ashcroft, has been stricken from the oral argument call of the day. So the court will move to the fifth case of the morning, number 022838, Fidel Davis against Michael L. Holmes.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Greg Bailey, and I represent the petitioner appellant, Fidel Davis. This case comes before the court on this court's grant of a certificate of appealability following the district court's denial of Mr. Davis' habeas petition, which was filed pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 2254. The issue certified by this court was whether the state court's resolution of Mr. Davis' ineffective assistance of counsel claims was a reasonable application of Strickland, and also requested that the parties address the procedural default ruling of the district court. During the briefing, the state conceded that the procedural default ruling was erroneous, and accordingly, the only contested issue remaining is the reasonableness of the state's application of Strickland to the facts of Mr. Davis's case. On September 2nd, 1996, Del Davis stabbed and killed Donovan Coleman in a fight that occurred in Davis's living room. Davis claimed that the fight was in self-defense. In preparing for his trial, his attorneys failed to investigate several key witnesses who would have had information relating to this issue, including an eyewitness, impeachment witnesses, and propensity for violence witnesses. In order to obtain relief under 2254, Mr. Davis must show that the state court's decision was either contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law.
Mr. Bailey, given the fact that, for reasons that you've discussed, we don't actually have affidavits from these individuals, isn't it the case that the very most we could do at this stage of the game would be to order an evidentiary hearing? I don't see how we could actually decide in Mr. Davis's favor.
It is true that normally affidavits are required, and we have acknowledged the large body of case law stating that. The bulk of our briefs that deal with the prejudice analysis are still relevant because in order to obtain an evidentiary hearing in this instance, we would either have to comply with the limitations in 2254E2 or fit within an exception that doesn't require us to apply with those limits. We've argued in our brief that due to Mr. Davis's diligence in state court in attempting to obtain an evidentiary hearing, that we do not have to comply with the limitations in E2, and therefore are entitled to an evidentiary hearing under pre-AEDPA law, which allows an evidentiary hearing if Davis is able to allege facts that, if proved, would entitle him to relief. So his statement in his post-conviction relief petition, in which he outlines the proposed testimony of these witnesses who are not investigated, if it turns out that he is able to prove that in an evidentiary hearing in the district court, and that would entitle him to relief under 2254, then he has met his burden of establishing his right to an evidentiary hearing.
Okay, and I take it that the question that would be asked in such a hearing would be the Strickland questions, incompetence of performance and whether prejudice in the sense of undermining confidence in the outcome had been shown.
That is correct, Judge Wood. And in this instance, there has been no meaningful dispute on the deficiency prong, because a long line of cases in this court and in the Supreme Court have held that a complete failure to investigate potential witnesses, particularly an eyewitness, is deficient under Strickland. So the central dispute really centers on the prejudice analysis. And in this case, the sole issue at trial was whether or not Davis had a reasonable apprehension of fear sufficient to justify killing Coleman in self-defense. And as a result, the nature of the fight, the existence of a second knife, and the propensity of violence of the victim were central to this issue. Several of the witnesses that were not investigated would have provided testimony valuable to those issues. that many of the details of the fight were not in dispute, including that Coleman was 15 years younger and intoxicated at the time of the fight, that he had refused to leave Davis's home, that he had threatened Davis. The record also reflects that a second bloodstained knife was found at the scene of the crime. However, there was a dispute as to whether or not Coleman had used that knife during the fight.
Now, focusing for a second on Mr. Love's testimony, he testifies that he's sleeping during a good bit of this fight, right?
That is correct.
So how can he testify that at no time did Coleman have a knife?
His testimony was that he was asleep through much of the incident, and the record is not particularly clear about which times he was awake and which times he wasn't, but he did testify that he did not see the knife in Coleman's hand. And he later admitted that it was possible that he told Mr. Davis's neighbor that right after the incident that he may not have had a knife. However, that testimony was never sufficiently impeached, as it would have been had an investigation been done by Davis's attorneys. They had called Mr. Williams.
Is that Williams you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah. The other testimony that was offered by the state in support of the argument that Coleman had a knife was the testimony of Detective Halloran, who stated that Davis gave a statement after he was arrested in which he admitted that Coleman did not have a knife. However, Davis denied making the statement and explained that the statement was taken at a time when he was intoxicated and incoherent from the trauma of these events.
This is the statement that was made supposedly on the 2nd of September that's not memorialized till the 4th of October?
That is correct. Mr. Davis claimed that the statement was not voluntarily given, essentially, because he was incoherent. And one of the witnesses that was not investigated was a neighbor of his who would have corroborated his incoherent state of mind at the time the statement was allegedly given. Detective Halloran had testified during the suppression hearing that Coleman was sober and lucid at the time he gave this statement. So her testimony would have been helpful in challenging the incriminating statement, and it would also have been helpful in challenging the credibility of Detective Halloran. Unfortunately for Davis, the trial came down to his word versus that of an eyewitness and that of a Chicago police officer. However, had he been able to present testimony of an additional eyewitness and been able to impeach the testimony of the one eyewitness who did testify, been able to challenge the incriminating statement and the credibility of the police officer who testified as to that statement, and been able to put in some propensity for violence witnesses, there's a better than equal chance that the results of this trial could have been different, and that easily meets the prejudice standard as articulated by this court.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. We'll hear now from Mr. Benton.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Russ Benton. I'm with the Office of the Illinois Attorney General. I'm here on behalf of the respondent. Last week, the United States Supreme Court, in its very first decision of the term, reiterated its longstanding principles regarding ineffective assistance of counsel on habeas actions, and noted that if a state court has already rejected an ineffectiveness claim, the state court's application of the governing federal law challenge, it must be shown not only to be erroneous and objectively unreasonable.
But we know that. I mean, the problem with the state court's consideration here is at one point when the state court gets the issue, before Mr. Davis has really managed to present it, it articulates the wrong legal standard. It says that it has to be convinced that the result would change, which isn't the legal standard. You have to show that your confidence in the outcome, a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome, is actually the language from Strickland. And Mr. Davis never gets the chance, despite alerting, even at the pretrial stage, the trial court, to the fact that there's another eyewitness by the name of Moses, he says, that hasn't been presented. He begs and pleads throughout this to develop the record, and it's never developed. And I don't think the Supreme Court was talking about that situation when it articulated the obviously correct standard that you note for habeas review.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the Illinois Appellate Court on Direct Review used Strickland, properly discussed what the requirements of Strickland was.
And misarticulated the test. That's the trouble.
Well, I don't think they misarticulated the test. I think what they did is with the facts and the persons before Deanna Bradley and Chubby Williams, they said, look, these people, even if they had testified, would not have allowed for relief.
But it doesn't know what their testimony would, you know, well,
what?
It thinks it's trying to say, would the result have changed? And that's, of course, the wrong standard.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with in the sense that, as counsel has stated in his brief, that Mr. Davis didn't have the opportunity to get a full and fair hearing. One
You're
of
kidding.
The
when did the state ever give him an opportunity to even present this evidence? He asked at the post-conviction stage, and that he was not given.
He was given the opportunity at the post-conviction stage to discuss the witnesses who were not, he felt, deserved to have been called, Williams and Bradley. That's all he did.
No, he also mentioned Moses at the pretrial stage. It's in the transcript.
Even now, even if he had discussed Moses, and the fact is not only did he have in the post-trial record, he also had it on direct appeal that they were, he was able to bring these people, i.e. the full and fair hearing. Even now, at this point, we don't know what Moses would say. At this, some, any point, at no point before this, had he articulated what Moses would say. Even now before this court, having failed to put affidavits in at PC, he says, an eyewitness who could give more accurate testimony. Well, we don't know what that means. We don't
Do you
know-
think he means that Moses Perry would have said there was only one knife? Why would he be fighting so hard to have Moses Perry? I mean, he was pro se a good bit of the way through this.
I don't think...
Because his lawyers at his direct appeal were pretty pitiful.
Well, I don't think, Your Honor, in all due respect, I don't think we know exactly what Moses would say. There are no affidavits. They say he could have said this, he could have said that. He could have said anything. There are reasons why an affidavits are required.
Which is why I asked, isn't the most we could do at this point to have an evidentiary hearing? I'm not saying that on the basis of these proffers, we know what Moses Perry would have said. I quite agree with you in that sense that there is more. He has suggested, though, that Perry would have given this account. We don't even know what happened during most of this fight because Love was asleep.
But we
I think that's pretty.
We also have testimony from the defendant, or from Sidell Davis.
Which he would have impeached from Deanna Bradley.
Well,
right.
I don't
That's what she would have said. She would have said he was intoxicated and confused.
And that, well, first of all, that and that would have allowed, and the direct appeal court had that in front of it. I don't agree with what they said in their brief, even though they have a direct cite that says, on the day of trial, trial counsel admitted no investigation. I don't think that's in the record. I think that's, I don't want to say that's a miscite, but that's clearly not in the record. All trial counsel said is, these witnesses would not have been, would not have allowed me to say what, you know, I didn't think I needed them. In terms of an evidentiary hearing, the defendant says, quote, you know, I use due diligence. I ask for an evidentiary hearing. That's not the standard. Every person on appeal in Illinois at the PC stage wants an evidentiary hearing. You must make a substantial showing of a constitutional violation. And that wasn't made here. There are no affidavits. There is no, there was trial record attached, but I don't think the trial record says that. Counsel also says, look, this, you should use the standard under for an evidence hearing for the pre-AEDPA, and alleges, and that's, that requirement alleges, A, that if facts proven to entitle relief, I don't think that's here, and the state courts never gave him a full and fair hearing. The state courts did give him a hearing. They gave him a post-trial hearing. They gave him a direct appeal. The direct appeal court did look at the witnesses. Those were the only people in front of it. There were other people could have been raised and weren't before it.
But
how does that deal with the question of whether the on direct appeal, the appellate court used the right standard? You still have to deal with that, don't you?
Well, I do think the appellate court understated Strickland, and as the U.S. Supreme Court said in Viscotti, it's not a matter of sometimes, as the court said, sometimes they themselves don't say reasonable probability, for instance. I think they did use the standard. I think they did look and say what these witnesses, the only witnesses before them at either stage, would they have been able to grant relief, and they didn't. I do want to mention...
Well, and how can you do a Strickland argument on direct appeal anyway? The state court didn't have before it any information about what counsel was doing. The state court didn't know if counsel had investigated for 3 months, if counsel had never spent 2 minutes investigating, the state court had no knowledge as to whether this was a strategic decision. Direct appeal is a bad time, as we constantly remind people, to assess these kinds of claims, because there's no record.
But direct appeal is, it may be the bad time and the least effective time, but it's still an opportunity. I'm sorry.
No, there's no record. You don't have any idea. Lawyers don't stand up because of good attorney-client privilege reasons and go into every last detail of their trial strategy on the record in the initial proceeding.
But you can do that. You can, if you have separate counsel, bring in the record. You can't...
Which isn't going to have anything in it. That's the problem, unless you have some rule in Illinois that appellate courts conduct de novo factual findings, which I don't think you do.
If, in fact, Mr. Davis had talked to his direct appeal counsel and said, look, I want these witnesses, and he did that in a sense. They were able to bring Bradley, and they were able to bring Williams, and there were other witnesses that he could have mentioned, and he didn't. I do think at that point it's enough for the court to see, here are the people, here is what they would have testified to.
Mr. Benton, at the post-trial stage in the trial court, before any direct appeal was taken, okay, the trial court did inquire as to why counsel did not call these witnesses. Am I correct?
Yes, they did.
If I may, at that time, the original trial counsel was still representing the defendant, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the court made an inquiry of the attorney whose performance really was on the line, am I right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I see. And that is the sum and substance of the record that then eventually went to the appellate court, is that correct?
That is the record, yes, Your Honor. That is the record that went to the appellate court with different counsel.
That's the next question I was going to ask. He did have different counsel on appeal.
Yes, Your Honor.
But that counsel was limited by the record that had been made in the trial court. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, the issue as it was framed by that appellate court was whether the trial court had adequately investigated the matter. Isn't that the way it was actually formulated by your appellate court?
Well, it was formulated. It was raised to it, failure to investigate the claim the attorney was in effect. But to do so, Your Honor, you still have to go under the underlying factual background. You still have to examine the factual matters underlying the claim. Mm-hmm. You can't say what the trial court was in effect, you know, should have investigated ineffectiveness if it doesn't go into what ineffectiveness there was at that point. And so thus, they could have brought that up. In fact, they did bring that up with the witnesses Williams and Bradley. There's one other point I wanted to make, Your Honor. Counsel brought in, and I don't know if he's going to use it on rebuttal or not, the fact that Patrick Hampton, a case that was decided by this court, I would say, put to the court, that case has no bearing as an entirely different case and standard than this case, because in that case there were affidavits put forth by other witnesses. In that case, the defendant was found not guilty of certain crimes. Neither one of them were done here. That the court used the affidavits brought forth in habeas to make a verdict on that case, and that only because other affidavits and other defendants were also acquitted in that case. So I think that's a very poor analogy to this case. And so if the court has no further questions, I would thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Benton. Mr. Bailey? We'll make that an even three.
May it please the court. As in their brief, the state today relies on the Illinois Appellate Court's direct review as the Strickland analysis to which Davis is entitled. I think the first and foremost important thing to remember is if that's the case, then the analysis fails on the contrary to prong of Strickland, because the standard applied by that court was clearly stricter than the prejudice standard required under Strickland. Second, I think that to impose a duty on a defendant who is in trial and may be receiving ineffective assistance of counsel to somehow inject a factual record into the trial record so that that can be used for his later ineffective assistance of counsel claim on direct review is unreasonable. And I would also like to point out that in this case, the fact that the Illinois Appellate Court had mentioned a couple of the witnesses that are at issue here that were not investigated, that was done in the context of a different argument. It was not done after his opportunity to say, I have received ineffective assistance of counsel because my attorneys have failed to investigate these seven witnesses. Rather, he was confined at that time to an argument based under Illinois law that the Illinois trial court did not sufficiently investigate his claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. So even if that is to be his analysis, and even if we were to overlook the fact that they apply the wrong standard, it still would fail under the unreasonable application prong because they don't weigh all of the witnesses that Davis claims were not investigated, and Supreme Court precedent has made clear that these matters are to be investigated and analyzed under the totality of the circumstances. Finally, I'd like to point out that the recent decision in Hampton, I believe, it is factually dissimilar in the sense that there was a full record developed there. However, the court was very explicit in the standards for obtaining an evidentiary hearing, and we believe that we made the exact same argument in our brief that the Hampton court relied on, and it's also noteworthy that in Hampton, the state failed to address any of the diligence arguments made by the petitioner in that case, and this court essentially held that to be a waiver of any arguments respecting diligence in seeking an evidentiary hearing in a state court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Mr. Bailey, you took this case by appointment of the court. You have the deep thanks of the court for the fine service that you and your law firm rendered on his behalf today upon our request. Thank you very much. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel for their fine briefs today, and the case will be taken under advisement.